Oh, Connor, you were in my dreams last night.
Yeah, I know. I'm aware.
Oh, good. That's great. You have that power?
Yeah.
You know what the figure in my dream was of you, Craig? I think it was Connor.
Whoa.
Hey, I was busy last night.
Welcome, Secret Movie Clubbers, to Secret Movie Club Podcast 26. Today's topic are monster movies in all their sizes and shapes and variations. We're going to anchor it on Jaws because we just watched Steven Spielberg's Jaws at our drive-in or parking lot cinema. And then I believe we're going to be talking about The Host. We're going to be talking about Godzilla. And we're also going to be talking about other variations of the monster movie. Who's with us today?
Hello, it's Daniel Ott.
Rawr, it's Connor.
No, it's me. The man, the myth, legend, living the dream of the American dream here in this world that we call life, me.
Edwin, just for kicks for me, I want you to define the word humility. What does that word mean when you hear that word?
What is humility?
Humility.
I don't know.
Okay, that's my point. Would you look it up? And, and then for the next podcast, you can just tell me what it means. But what I did was like a move. I'm sorry. We need to talk about humility, Edwin. You could totally reject it. Many of our greats have rejected it.
I don't know what it means.
I know. We'll talk. So humility is the concept that not thinking you're better or greater than anyone and always allowing for the possibility that you might lack information. And so you approach everything cautiously rather than claiming knowledge of everything or greatness.
That was confusing.
I think Edwin exists where he doesn't believe that. There is no. He is a superior being.
Yeah,
but I was going to say, listen, some of my favorite people, Muhammad Ali, Kobe Bryant, Mozart, their statements were not the most humble. So look, maybe you just know your greatness and you're just not pussyfooting around. The greatest. Is that Muhammad?
Yeah. That's funny you said that. I just watched this last night.
He's my favorite athlete of all time. Amazing, amazing, amazing person. But there you go. Anyway, my name's Craig, programmer, founder of Secret Movie Club. Announcements for this week. We are doing this in mid-September. And this upcoming weekend, 11th, 12th, and 13th, on the 11th, we're doing Alien Aliens double feature. On the 12th, yes, we got approved. We are doing Star Wars and the Empire Strikes Back. So Star Wars A New Hope. Episode 4, I guess, technically, and episode 5, Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back. I am contractually obligated to introduce it that way because I made an agreement with Lucasfilm, and I'm very grateful to them, but that is the way I have to introduce them. We are doing that double feature this Saturday.
I'm contractually obligated to murder you if you don't.
And then on Sunday, our sci-fi family film is Pixar's WALL-E. So all the movies I just mentioned are going to be at our Glendale Sears parking lot, and Glendale Sears is our home, probably for the next few months at least. But next Thursday, we're doing two Cole 80 sci-fi movies, Tron and The Last Starfighter, and that is going to be at 1027 South Los Angeles Street, LA, California, 90015. A really cool, big, thank goodness, parking lot in downtown LA. We'd love to have you. All the movies that I just mentioned start at 7:45. The first movie starts at 7:45 p.m. because it's getting darker, so we can start it earlier, and we would love to have you. If you have any comments or suggestions, or I'm actually scheduling our Halloween, our October right now, it will be all horror or horror scary theme. Please write us. We'd love to hear them. Or just write us to tell us your thoughts about anything at community@secretmovieclub.com or podcast@secretmovieclub.com. That's it. Let's go. Is that a stein of lemonade, Connor? Oh, that looks delicious.
Wow, yeah.
Oh, man.
It is an authentically Australian one. My parents go on a lot of trips to Europe, and they brought me this back from Austria.
Oh, boom.
It's genuinely beautiful.
It is.
I want a stein of lemonade. If for people who are listening to this 700 years in the future or who are just not here in Los Angeles, Los Angeles just had what potentially might be its biggest heat wave of all time. On Sunday, it got to be 116 and 17 degrees.
It was a really tiny heat wave, though. I haven't experienced that here yet. That feels like Texas weather where I feel like it's kind of, I mean, it's not completely done, but it feels fine now. And it felt fine on Friday. And so it was literally just the weekend. Like, usually when it gets hot here like that, it gets hot here for like a week or two.
Yeah, it was really for people who are still in denial about maybe the environment being affected by certain things. That heat wave was very funky and the hottest I've ever known it in L.A. Everybody busted their butts at our parking lot cinema, so thank you.
I was going to say, on Saturday night, it was 110 degrees and there was no sun in the sky. It was 9 o'clock at night and it was just roasting and I couldn't figure out how that worked.
But we're here to talk about it. None of us roasted so much that we became edible. So we're here. And speaking of edible,
speaking of sunshine,
yeah, we're going to start off talking about the first monster movie, Steven Spielberg's Jaws, which in many ways, although there are many different kinds of monster movies, as Edwin will talk about with Godzilla, so I don't want to step on any toes, but really, Jaws is a gold standard of monster movies. It's usually for people who love Spielberg, and I love Spielberg. It's almost everybody who loves Spielberg, one of their top five. Not everybody, but a lot of people. It's definitely in my top five. One of the most perfect movies I've ever seen made. Ironically, a movie that was miserable to make, that had no script when they shot, really, to speak of, that went through tons of changes in production, went months over budget, and yet Spielberg, his genius, his editor Verna Fields, the actors, the writers, they figured it out and created this gem that we're watching 40 years later.
It really, I mean, beyond just whatever gold standard of monster movies, it kind of changed movies in period in this country, and is usually seen as like the beginning of the blockbusters.
It did, although we should get into this. Maybe we'll get into it right now. I would say, and I want to say this the right way. I would say, had Jaws come out but no Star Wars, I actually think the blockbuster would have gone a slightly different direction.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, I think that Jaws, and then 2 years later, Star Wars was like a 1-2 punch.
But Jaws was like usually noted as the beginning of that era.
Totally. And yeah, actually, let's just talk about real quickly. Prior to Jaws, even great movies like Godfather were only released in a few theaters in the country, and they would roadshow. So they would play like 2 weeks in Chicago, 2 weeks in New York or whatever. And if they were hits, they'd just continue on. Whenever a movie would play in, say, 500 theaters in the country, it was considered a dud. And what it was the studio just trying to get money before everybody realized how much it sucked. And then when Jaws came out, everybody loved it. And the studio was like, people are lining up 24 hours. Let's release it in 1,000 theaters and make it a cash machine. And as Connor said, that essentially created the model that still exists today, which is for the biggest blockbusters, they're going to eat up 2,000 screens or 1,000 screens, and they're going to be cash machines. And if they're good, they're going to be cash machines for like a month or two. And there are pros and cons to that.
Back then, it would have been longer than a month or two. Nowadays, it's a month or two.
Yeah, at most. But so Jaws is, of course, about this sleepy tourist town called Amityville.
Amity Island.
Amity Island, forgive me. Amity Island. And a shark begins to kill people, and the sheriff, played by Roy Scheider, is torn between the local politics and what's right to try to figure out how to get these killings to stop.
Probably one of the greatest motion pictures ever made in cinematic history of film. I saw it when I was about probably like 9 years old. I always thought the shark was real for some reason. I always thought it was real. I don't know why.
Well, that's a testament to the movie maker.
Yeah, I know. But after I found out more and more and more about it as I grew up more, and knowing that they went through hell filming the movie, it's really amazing. The shark didn't work, the boat sank, the sound crew say, screw the actors, save the sound equipment. There's a whole behind the scenes footage on one of the special features which I watched a lot of times, because it's really amazing how they talk about that movie.
Robert Shaw was drunk the whole time.
Oh yeah, Robert Shaw was drunk. They had to have an assistant to watch them, but that assistant would end up getting drunk with him, and he had to get another assistant for that. Essentially, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. I had the opportunity to see it on 35mm at the New Beverly Cinema, one of the best screenings I ever went to. It was so great. Knowing that the one scene that's going to scare people, I just looked around, I was like, okay, I'm ready.
The one scene?
Yeah, you know the scene where the head pops out of the boat, and then Richard Dreyfuss is like, woo! That one is my iconic, especially the John Williams score. Dude, perfection. Just saying, I like Jaws 2 more. Just saying, okay? All right?
I don't even know what to do with that.
Hate me? Hate me.
No, I don't hate you. I love that you're flying your freak flag and doing your thing. And I just don't. But I've never seen Jaws 2. So maybe if I saw Jaws 2, I'd be like, Edwin's right. Has anyone else seen Jaws 2?
No.
Wow.
That's a fun opinion. I'm okay with that opinion.
Also, if you're a movie maker, you do become, or I have become obsessed with Jaws trivia because it's such a instructive story about how a talented director went through hell to become who he became. So the trivia and the minutiae about it is boundless. And I keep, every time you were saying something, Edwin, I wanted to add trivia.
When I watched it this weekend, I tried to look up something on IMDb trivia page. I Google searched it and it went to the trivia. And then I was literally scrolling for 15 minutes trying to find the specific thing I wanted to find. It was like a nightmare. I didn't even find it.
Yeah, Jaws is like one of the most trivia movies, if you know the behind the scenes. But one of the interesting things here, Edwin, is we're calling Jaws a monster movie, which I think it's fair to call it, but a great white shark is not a monster per se. It's an animal in the natural kingdom. What do you think it qualifies as a monster movie or no?
You know, that's a tough one because yeah, I've seen my fair share of monster movies and sea creatures as well, but I think it's not essentially a monster movie. It's more when nature attacks.
Right. Yeah, yeah, which is its own genre.
That's how I see it.
Like the birds.
The birds, you know, orca, the killer whale, alligators, you know. Actually, no, I take that back. That's considered a monster because they grow to ridiculous monster size. I take that back.
So, Connor, what do you think of Jaws?
It's great. I love it. I've talked about Spielberg, how much I like him in the past. I think I talked about how I was trying to watch through all his movies. I kind of hit a roadblock there, but I'm still going. It's in my top five of his films. It's this, the first two Indiana Joneses, and the two Tom Cruise collabs.
Oh, that's an interesting list. Those are all dynamite movies.
Yeah. The big thing, I don't know if it's just being alone in this apartment for this long, but boy, did this feel weirdly relevant watching it. I don't know if everything is feeling relevant more and more, but like the way people are like, we have to open up. We can't just sit here. Like, who cares? You know, some people died.
You know, it's funny you said that because when COVID hit and we all got shut down and May came, I don't know if you guys noticed all the Facebook memes that quoted Jaws, and they would often show the mayor and he'd be like, we got to open up for the fourth. And I mean, you're hitting on something great, which is that Jaws has this sort of fascinating first half, second half structure. And I've been obsessed with this because there are movies that have this. You know, Kubrick movies are famous for this. Clockwork Orange has a first half, second half. Barry Lyndon has a first half, second half structure. Full Metal Jacket has a first half, second half structure. And Jaws, the first half is on the land and the second half is out at sea. And the part that's on the land really is more about the internal politics of a town than it is about a shark.
My mom grew up in California, and she said the year this came out, I don't remember if she was living in Southern or Northern California at that point, but she said that her and her friends did not go to the beach for years, literally years after this, that it scarred them and no one could talk them out of the fear. And I think it affected some of the beach, like beach going business, because people were so afraid of just getting in the water. Which I think is fascinating from an art standpoint, that the cultural impact of it, beyond the idea of what a blockbuster it may have started, that it would scare you so much that you don't do something that like your state is famous for. But it is sort of insane. I think it works so well on its own, but then you add on all these layers of everything that went wrong and somehow they made a masterwork out of it. I think that's a testament beyond the art to the art of the filmmaking. And how old was he? 25 or something when he made this? Or how old was he?
Crazy. He was born in 46. So when they started shooting, he was 28, roughly. 27, 28.
It's one of those that's so ingrained in my brain and in pop culture that it's hard to have any original thought on it because it is so effective, and the reason people say it is effective, and anytime someone releases some writing that's some new deep dive or there's some new piece of information, it just continues to add to this wild legacy of this thing that should not exist the way it exists.
It's fascinating to me because Spielberg was hired to do Jaws off a Duel, which I think is brilliant. And the funny thing, and I think about this with Spielberg, is Duel was meant to be a movie of the week. And Spielberg was a TV director for hire. And he somehow found a way to make a TV movie of the week. I mean, when you really think about that, I think you guys are a little young to remember TV movies of the week as they existed when I was a kid. But before there was cable or HBO or Netflix, the intermediary between TV and movies were these TV movies of the week. But they were never directed, for the most part, they were directed like TV shows. They were just 2-hour TV shows with a slightly higher budget. But when you saw Duel, it is it's just its own thing. And I think weirdly, Spielberg was probably hired to shepherd this bestseller, but with the understanding that, hey, you know, he's a young guy, he's gonna be a team player. And I think he was hired to be a craftsman, a journeyman director. I really think he was hired to put out, like, you know, sort of a Towering Inferno or a Poseidon Adventure. You know, he was meant to be a journeyman or taking a Pelham 1-2-3, all Dynamite movies. But he somehow made a Spielberg film. And I think the weird thing is that I'm almost sure that young directors after him always get pitched, hey, do this Marvel movie. Hey, do this. Hey, Spielberg had to do Jaws. Coppola had to do Godfather. And the funny thing is that very few directors, in my opinion, come out of that the way Spielberg did. I actually think, weirdly, that most people get chewed up by the system, or they like the money, or they just end up directing, like, in that series for 30 years. And it's not their fault. It's just sort of the way the industry is now. But to see someone like Spielberg go through hell, get Final Cut, and then go on to a career that's like Close Encounters, Raiders, E.T., Munich, Catch Me If You Can, Schindler's List, like literally somehow exist as both a hugely popular filmmaker and a singular artist. There's almost no one, although you could say Scorsese has had kind of a doppelganger trajectory, only Scorsese and Spielberg seem to be making $200 million art movies. And I just kind of, I look at Jaws constantly and I just try to figure out, can I get something out of it? Or is that just sui generis and it'll never happen again?
Kind of like Stephen King kind of exists like that in books.
Totally. Like. Yeah.
They remind me a lot of each other.
It's almost like timing because they both got popular at almost the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie was 73, 74.
Nolan might be the closest current working equivalent who sort of gets these blockbuster budgets to make quote unquote, you know, art films in whatever capacity. Yeah,
he does. And I have mad respect for Nolan. I want to be real clear. It's funny. I saw Dunkirk recently and I was like, man, I really liked it. And, you know, when we rewatched Inception, I liked it way more than I did prior. And I'm looking forward to Tenet. But I don't feel like Nolan, and this is not a knock because, look, Hitchcock made suspense thrillers his whole life and they're amazing. But Spielberg, he does whatever genre he wants to.
That's very true.
And while
yeah.
there are a lot of strikeouts, I wouldn't actually say strikeouts. Sometimes I'd say maybe like singles. You could say Spielberg has got, you could just name, rattle off a whole bunch of genres that Spielberg nailed.
Yeah.
And I don't know that you can say other directors have done that.
No, you're right. I just meant in the capacity of sort of having a freedom that no one really gets anymore. I feel like, especially in the current world, I don't know if there's any other director outside of him, because he and Scorsese still kind of operate that way, currently working like Nolan in that regard, regardless of opinions.
But it's even fun. I mean, I think we're getting to something here that I really obsess about.
I was just thinking of other people. I think maybe like their careers are shorter, but like Coen Brothers and PTA, maybe.
But here's the funny thing I guess I'm trying to get at, and it's a personal thing, is that even Paul Thomas Anderson, the Coens, or Chris Nolan, or even Quentin Tarantino, they know what they're good at. And as their careers go on, I notice them, they stay within a budget, or they know kind of their tone. And listen, the Coen brothers also have killed it in every genre they've done. But you can't really say the Coen brothers are doing $200 million movies.
Yeah.
I just don't get how Spielberg, I mean, I get it, but he's just making these $100 to $150 million movies with complete creative control, and yet they are big risks. I know everyone in the rearview mirror is like, oh, that was going to be a hit. But I'm like, really? Maybe E.T. was going to be a hit. No one knew that.
And there's sort of, going back to what you were saying about these directors for hire that are kind of thrown into these things, there's sort of an interesting thing happening right now, which is companies like Disney using The Mandalorian as a proving ground for sort of untested directors, where they have a showrunner who's an established filmmaker that leads a lot of young directors to like test before they're given a bigger project, probably for Marvel or Disney, which is really interesting to see too. Because you get people like Bryce Dallas Howard, you get Deborah Chow, who directed like maybe the best episodes of The Mandalorian, and she's now directing the entire Obi-Wan spinoff series. So there's sort of this weird like
farm team
building thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a great model. You know, back in the 30s and 40s, you would do that with B movies. And then the B movie director could occasionally work their way up to the A movie. And I think that's great. Before we get too sort of left field of the monster thing, coming back to Jaws, but I think this is the conversation, is how Spielberg took what for all intents and purposes was meant to be just a money-making bestseller adaptation and turned it into this weird 70s improv-y, brilliantly directed suspense thriller character study. One of the things Spielberg said, and then I'm going to throw it to you, is he said editing the movie with Verna Fields, and I don't mean to get nutty here, but these are my obsessions. I love editing. I've edited everything I've ever done. Now, I don't think that I'm going to continue to do that. I think I would be probably benefited by pairing up with a great editor and just having the work get better. I really, as I get older, I believe, like, hey, put your ego to the side. But like Akira Kurosawa edited all his movies. The Coen brothers edited their movies, and Spielberg and Scorsese are heavy into their editing. And I think that Jaws is one of the greatest editor-director movies I've ever seen. And Spielberg said a lot of that was Verna Fields. A lot of that was him. Verna Fields won the Academy Award for Jaws. But he said the difference between the shark being amazing and the shark just looking like a floating turd was literally one frame or two frames. And they struggled for months. And so everything we take for granted, like the shark coming out or going under the boat, he said it would be one frame and they'd be like, this is awful. And then they'd paste the frame back and take a frame off the head and they'd be like, this is amazing.
I was just going to say a different thing that I love about Jaws, which is those three performances are incredible.
Oh, totally.
That cabin scene is like... Blockbusters and that type of cinema have sort of, this is like a, this, that's like also like its own trope, like the idea of the quiet scene that takes place in like an action adventure type thing towards the end of the second act, beginning of the third, wherever all the characters just kind of chill out and things are kind of not going well and they all just talk and yeah, it's an incredible sequence. And it's just character, it's literally just them talking about themselves, but in a way that feels extremely naturalistic, and that highlights all three of their like performances and the differences between them.
And it just going to brilliant writing and stuff, it's still totally germane to the movie, because they compare scars and you get the Indianapolis monologue, which is horrifying. Yeah, it's just for people who haven't seen Jaws, which I'm sure are very few, when you see it, one of the things that doesn't get talked about as much is how 70s it feels. It's just totally like a 70s character movie that happens to have a shark, which is a really weird thing. They hired him because of Duel, and Spielberg always said his pitch to get Jaws was it's Duel in the Sea. And he's made Duel three times. I'm sure you guys could guess what the third Duel movie was.
Schindler's.
It's not 1941, is it?
No.
War Horse? BFG?
It's Jurassic Park.
Yeah, it's Jurassic Park.
Son of a bitch.
No, I'm pretty sure. I think Connor was right.
One of the funny things, actually, this is maybe good advice for all of us if we're ever in this situation. Whenever the Coens have to reset, they have always reset with a noir piece. I don't know if you guys have noticed this. Like, they do Blood Simple, and then if they have a movie that doesn't quite work, they do Fargo. And then if they have a round where they're like, then they do No Country for Old Men. It's been kind of fascinating. They'll come back to genre and murder. And Spielberg, when he's had to reset, he's always reset with a Duel. So he did Duel. He did Sugarland, which didn't quite work. He did Jaws. He went on, obviously had this crazy run. And then after Hook, he reset with Jurassic Park, which he said is Duel with dinosaurs. Godzilla. Why is Godzilla around 70 years later? Why can't we get enough of Godzilla, Edwin?
Because he's the king of the monster. You can't stop the king of the monster. He's like the most badass thing ever created by man.
We're now moving to a very Japanese monster genre known as kaiju.
So kaijus are superb beings that are created from man-made things, or they've been around for centuries. They're giant monsters that were created by man, or like I said, that have been around for many years. Godzilla is one of them because he was created by an atomic bomb. I think he was created from a lizard or a dinosaur, because they did explain that in Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah. So Godzilla is an atomic nuclear monster that shoots an atomic breath that gives off radiation, which if you see Godzilla 1954, it is a metaphor for the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombing, and Godzilla was the basis for that. And it's pretty horrifying to see, because I remember I told you when you showed it at the Vista that damn, they're bringing kids to this? This has some pretty horrific stuff.
There's never, even the darker Godzillas that come later, like Godzilla versus Destoroyah or some of the other darkers, none of them are as horrific as the first Godzilla.
No, the first one is like the most darkest one ever. But there is Godzilla 1984, which kind of goes back to the basis of that, which is ignoring the things in the past and just focusing on the first one, which they did.
I feel like I've only seen a couple, but I feel like Shin Godzilla kind of does that too.
Oh, yeah.
Shin Godzilla is one of the darker ones too, and one of the great ones. But definitely it plays with the mythology a little bit. And I don't want to ruin it because the last shot of Shin Godzilla is one of the great, like, last shots of the whole series. But how it explains what Godzilla is slightly different than the way they were explaining it prior. What do you think it is about Godzilla that people love?
There's two sides of him. There's the bad side where he just goes around destroying city, and there's the friendly side where he has to save the world. Me personally, I like the bad side. But he's also sort of an anti-hero because he does fight other monsters to stop it from destroying the world, like in Godzilla vs. Destoroyah, which is a huge one because you got a badass looking Godzilla, which is his last final movie. And I teared up to that movie. It made me tear up. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Oh, because he's got a kid, too.
Yeah, he's got a kid. And
another father-son story.
I'm going to spoil it for anyone. This movie has been around for years, so you should have seen it. But the last shot, you get a new Godzilla because I'm pretty sure his son is back from the dead from all that nuclear stuff from his father. But it's something, you know, kids look up to back in the 70s and early in 90s. I don't know if you know Cinemassacre. That dude is a huge Godzilla fan, and if it wasn't for him, that dude, I would have discovered more Godzilla movies from there. I only saw Godzilla vs. Mothra, Godzilla's Revenge, Rodan, and Godzilla 1954 with Raymond Burr, which is pretty good, I might say so.
Edwin, I associate Godzilla heavily with you and a lot of monster movies. When you first saw these, what about them, like, what captivated you just as a kid and what captivates you now? Like, what makes them so important to you?
They're important to me because, one, my father introduced me to them at a young age. My mother did not like it at all. But for me, it's kind of cool because they're dudes in suits that get destroy model buildings. And like for Jaws, I always thought the monsters were real too until I found out they're men in suits. So they're all so damn good, all of them, and especially the side monsters as well. Like I can name a couple: Frankenstein versus Baragon, Artagon, Space Amoeba, War of the Gargantuas, Mothra, Rodan. The list goes on, man.
It's strange. Godzilla has a unique thing too, where a lot of the villains and allies are sometimes just as known as he is to some capacity. Like people, even if you've never seen a Godzilla movie, there's a chance that you at least know the design of one of the things he fights. And the way that sort of got into American culture the same way it is in Japanese culture is kind of crazy. And
even within itself, like if you trace the lineage of the kaiju film with Godzilla, and because something we haven't mentioned that isn't really relevant to the ones we're talking about, but is like mechas are like a big thing in kaiju films a lot of times.
Yeah.
And the way that led eventually into things like Gundam and Evangelion, which itself then led back into Shin Godzilla, which is the most recent reinvention of Godzilla.
Because that was directed by the guy who did Evangelion,
Hideaki Anno.
You know, for mechas, eventually, Mechagodzilla was a bad guy, and he was going to be the main enemy for it, but after a few movies, and what is it? The Heisei series?
Yeah, Showa era, Heisei era, Millennium era. Now it's a new era.
The Heisei era, we get Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla 2, which they redesigned Mechagodzilla and made him into a good guy trying to kill Godzilla, which they never do because the government are idiots because they can't kill Godzilla. Can't kill him.
There's also this interesting thing, I think, about Godzilla. In our, how many Godzilla movies did we do last summer?
Something like 8 to 11.
The coolest thing I thought to see is that Godzilla walks a weird line between, in terms of its fan base, because a lot of it was parents bringing their kids to see it for the first time. And there's an interesting dynamic where it can somehow be effective and entertaining to a kid, even though a lot more of the movie is talking than I remember as a kid seeing it, which is interesting because I remember it as like these crazy action movies, but in reality, there's a lot of buildup to an eventual action scene. But then it works for both levels. It works in the same way I think the best Pixar movies work. And I mean that as in it appeals to the sort of visceral nature that a child needs to like take on with a film. Then a parent needs something more than just that because, you know, they need something more to attach to. And Godzilla kind of has that. And I wonder if any of like, you know, people that are operating in children's film world have used that as a basis to kind of find that balance, because it's really hard to do, and Godzilla and monster movies in general sort of have that in a degree that I've never really thought about before.
It's funny, Connor was, we were, before we started this, Connor was saying for our next podcast, we're really going to have to pick and choose. He was right. And I feel like we're almost there now, because we really need to do a podcast just devoted to Godzilla. So this is really just the prologue. This is like The Hobbit. This isn't even The Hobbit. This is like J.R.R. Tolkien's.
This is like when they release like a 10-minute opening in front of another movie.
Yeah, totally. There you go. Sneak preview. But the way that Godzilla evolves, even in the Showa era, is fascinating, because the first Godzilla, he is just the embodiment of nuclear terror. But by the time you get to Godzilla versus Hedorah, which is my personal favorite, when you get to Godzilla versus Hedorah, the little kid loves him. And like Godzilla turns around and waves to the little kid after he saved him from the smog monster. And you're like, wow. And now technically, that's not the same Godzilla, because Godzilla dies at the end of the first Godzilla. And then I guess Godzilla Raids Again explains the new Godzilla. But Edwin's gone.
Godzilla Raids Again sucks. Hold on a second.
But anyway, there's just the only thing I'll say about this, because we do have to keep moving on, is I didn't know anything about the movies really a lot until we did that series last year. And I got why people love them. It's just great to see him go against different. It's like wrestling for movie people. And you just watch Godzilla go against these different monsters and everything. And you're like, what dope move is he going to do? And then you get the formula and and you kind of go along with it. But the good directors figure out a way, like in Invasion of Astro Monster, there's this weird American dude who is just hitting on women the whole time. And so it's like a weird Godzilla kind of skeezy James Bond. And then it goes to space. And you're like, when they can do things with the formula, and for people who haven't seen Godzilla versus Hedorah, as Edwin said, it's the crazy one. There's a club sequence where everybody has fish heads.
It's the art house movie.
It's great. And it's very meta, and they're animated sequences, and Godzilla takes Hedorah's eyes and crushes them and then does this move, which is dope. There you go. So moving on, we're going to go to Daniel, who, per if you've been listening to our podcast, would know, is going to bring some South Korean flavor here. So, Daniel, the host.
The host from 2006. Thank you.
And so moving on to Connor.
The host is a surprise, surprise. It's a Bong Joon-ho film from 2006. And it's a take on the monster movie genre coming out of South Korea. And it takes a lot of the tropes that I think we've sort of discussed in this kind of mixes like an animal attack with a created monster. I don't know the exact terminology for kaiju, but perhaps it fits. But it's about a monster that's accidentally created by the American military, who have a base in South Korea, and they're dumping, I think it's formaldehyde, down the drain, and it drains into a river and creates some type of creature over the years that eventually attacks sort of the riverside town where a man and his family have a shop, and his daughter's kidnapped by the monster, and insanity ensues. But it's sort of interesting. It's a monster movie that has it's a family drama at the heart, which I think a lot of Bong Joon-ho's movies are multiple things. They're hard to give a genre to, so he sort of works in four genres at once. I remember the American box art had a thing that was like the best monster movie since Jaws. So I think that Jaws sort of perpetrates the idea of what a monster movie is, and they can just, you know, stack that onto the cover art to sell you on it. It's a character piece, and it works, I think, in a similar way that my comparison with it to Jaws would be, in the way that it works, that where you get a lot of time with the monster, but you also get a lot of time with the family, so that every time something, an encounter with them happens, you care, versus just having chaos, destruction kind of run rampant through it.
It's like the human drama is in the foreground, and the monster drama is always in the background.
It's not as scary as something like Jaws can be. It's much more focused in the characters, but also sort of class. And it's an angry movie, and I think it's a movie angry at the United States, because it's based on a real event I found out about in the early 2000s, that the United States military that have a base in Seoul were actually dumping formaldehyde into the sewer system that led into the river, and made a lot of citizens really angry with the United States, who were there doing this. And I don't think anyone was ever charged, despite the fact that they were found guilty. So it was a whole thing. And so that creature, and sort of as an answer to the way Godzilla was an answer to following post-war Japan, their answer, Bong Joon-ho made a movie that was an answer to this United States occupation, or their time in South Korea, just disrespecting sort of what they were doing. And my favorite little fun fact about the movie is that a creature designer and Bong Joon-ho named the creature Steve Buscemi because he based the personality of the creature off of Steve Buscemi's character in Fargo. His like persona in that sort of that unpredictable wild
card. I guess like any genre, I want to say that's genre, by which I mean horror, monster movie. You really can infuse it with whatever you want to if you're a talented enough or a visionary enough director. And I haven't seen enough Bong Joon-ho to really comment on him as a filmmaker. But having seen Parasite, it seems like Bong Joon-ho really has a societal and topical agenda with his genres.
Yeah, and I think he very actively works to not be constrained by the genre. So rather than, I mean, this is a, if you were to simplify it down to just being a monster movie, but I think he wants to tell a story that doesn't let you figure it out in the way that some genres kind of set themselves up to be, which isn't a problem. There's a form that works and is very functional and efficient, especially for short runtime things. But I think he wants to tell, use a bigger story and use the tropes of genre to tell it better, but to also kind of subvert them to make it interesting where you can't figure out where he's going with it, but not in a way that feels cheap or that he's trying to be like a, you know, wink wink, I'm smarter than you. More to make a story more interesting by using the tropes of genre to make it better, if that makes any sense in my rambling.
Absolutely. So let's Connor, what would you like to talk about monster movie wise?
Well, I misunderstood the prompt and I watched the 2003 Patty Jenkins film Monster.
That's fair.
About the serial killer Eileen Wuornos, which is a good movie. I did literally watch that.
But doesn't that count as a monster movie?
No.
Okay. No. Swami Craig.
It's a serial killer movie.
But isn't that a human monster movie?
Isn't the real monsters is humans?
Is us.
Aren't monsters the real humans? I couldn't think of something that I wanted to talk about that I didn't think we would talk about as its own thing. So like Alien or John Carpenter's The Thing, you know, there's no way to get into those in five minutes and stuff. But check out Monster. Charlize Theron, she's good in it. She should have won an award or something.
I don't mean this in a cute way, but I was going to say this. I think movies like Silence of the Lambs, which I have seen, I have not seen Monster. I know that Monster, I believe, is meant to be this character study of this really unsettling woman, but who is the way she is for reasons that become understandable. I haven't seen the movie, but...
Yeah, it's definitely, as someone who is burdened with knowledge of serial killers, it's definitely a heavily romanticized version of her story. But it takes a very human approach to Eileen Wuornos, who is a real woman who was abused and who killed a bunch of men. She said that they all were trying to assault her. It's possible that the first one was, which is what the movie portrays, but it's we don't really know for sure. In the movie, the first guy she kills is like a totally understandable, you know what I mean? It's self-defense. And then as it goes on, it becomes less and less so. And she starts doing it more and more for her own betterment.
One of the things one of the tropes about serial killers is that they're usually white men.
Mm-hmm.
So a movie like Monster, it really is singular in that it's a female serial killer.
Well, Eileen Wuornos is a pretty singular killer in general because women tend to... And someone at me if I'm wrong, but when they are serial killers and kill a lot of people, it's usually more like poisoning, things like that. It's like knives and guns are usually
the
realm of men when it comes to multiple murders. It's why like Carla Faye Tucker is someone who also stands out, even though she just killed the one person or the two people at once. She killed two people with a pickaxe. And she has a quote about how she had an orgasm every time she hit them.
Oh, yeah.
But Wuornos never had a sexual component to her kills. It was more, in the sense that she would lure them out as a prostitute. And, you know, at first it was in the movie, it's presented as, yeah, the first one was he was attacking her.
It's just, again, it's weird. I didn't necessarily think the monster movie genre, we should maybe go back to just talking about one movie, because there's so much to get into here. I feel like we're literally just doing a table of contents of things we should discuss, because the human as monster, whether it's a serial killer, those movies fascinate me. Because those people exist, and we suffer at their hands, whether they're serial killers or monsters that control or have been elected.
It's kind of the reverse engineering of something like a Frankenstein, which is like a classic monster movie example, I would say, obviously, the Universal Monsters, where Frankenstein is this monster who we begin to understand its humanity, and these movies sometimes are about someone who's presented as very human, and then we see them slide into being the bad parts.
Well, I would also argue that it's very unsettling, and it's very hard for me to go there, even though I have a natural fascination with murder and a natural fascination with when I, like, even the thing you said about the pickaxe, I really have no desire to, like, think about that or go deep into that. And I think it gets to that thing that there are some humans who are operating on a level that you're so afraid of that just the harm it causes people and stuff. It is fascinating to me, but it is monstrous in a way because it causes harm.
I should have gone with my other choice, Monster's Ball. I also haven't seen it, but it sounds like it would have been a good pick for this episode.
You know, Monster's Ball is an interesting movie. I have seen that one. That's sort of about how racism and bad habits can be passed down from generation to generation, which is that sort of thing, that horrible thing about how abuse and horrible ideology can the parent can create the child. And that's yet again something to talk about.
You know, just make a great monster movie, try not to use CGI, go for practical effects. You know, that's how monsters should be.
Like Spookies
did what so few other movies have
dared to do.
Yeah,
that clip you showed where the Grim Reaper fell off and they just cut the stock footage of some car blowing up in a forest, I was like, that is amazing.
There's some legitimately cool special effects, including a kind of, not kind of, I think an offensive stereotype, Asian Spider Woman lady, but
oh no,
her like head turns into this weird spider thing, and then she like sucks all the juice out of a guy and his like face deflates.
There was someone at the drive-in, as your thing started, your voiceover narration started, and it was like, the following is from Spookies, like nothing's been edited. And I saw this person walking away from the screen, and he stopped and turned around and then just didn't move for like the next 3 minutes.
So Connor has been cutting all our pre-shows, and I want to give it up for Connor. He's made these experiences really unique to Secret Movie Club, but that uniqueness is because of Connor. And so, Connor, thank you. You're making a really fun parking lot cinema experiences. That's not just us showing two movies. That's creating some more conversation. That's all because of you. So Connor's just editing and curating great stuff. And if you weren't listening to the previous podcast, Connor, can you give us a one-liner about Spookies?
It was an Evil Dead ripoff that had a bunch of random crap in it. Then the producers saw it and said, this isn't spooky enough. So they put a bunch of more random crap in it.
So check it out, Spookies.
I think it's all on YouTube.
What I want to say, Edwin, just to back you up, is we did also show the 80s Blob this weekend. Speaking of monster movies and practical effects, and there's really no contest when it's a real gelatinous thing and someone's in it, or when you see, like, there's that, it's really funny, really horrible, the one guy making out with the girl and he thinks they're about to have sex, and then he gets sucked into her chest, and a dude gets sucked into a drain, and it's really practical effects and optical blob. It is a lot of fun, and I never have that kind of fun when it's CGI, ever. I never have. I don't care how good the CGI is. I never have that kind of fun, but when it's practical, I'm like, oh, and you did it too. You and I were watching it side by side, and you and I were both like, gnarly.
The part I really like from that movie is when the scientist gets it, because you know he's the bad guy in the movie, and he gets the most gnarly kill ever. He's like, ah! I love that. That's badass.
Yeah, that's a trope in those movies. You never see from, like, their bottom down, but you know they're just getting eaten. Pop culture. culture and final thoughts. Let's go around the horn. It is mid-September 2020. What are you guys engaging in?
I've been playing Red Dead Redemption 2. I've been shooting up sheriffs, you know, trying to have my own little Wild Bunch shootout. You know, I've been successful. I've been really successful. I'm trying to find ghosts. Trying to do that, trying to find Bigfoot and then find Bigfoot and kill him. And then,
that's an incredible game.
It is. It's pretty f-ing great. I'm the man with no name. I've been playing a lot of Ennio Morricone soundtracks during the game. I was just playing the game right now after this podcast, which I'm going to continue playing.
Edwin, you live the life of kings.
I know.
It's just, you woke up, you played some Red Dead 2. You talked to us on the podcast. You're going to stay and play some more Red Dead 2 when this is done.
When we leave the drive-in and I go home, I'm playing Red Dead. And I don't go to bed until 5 a.m. because that game is so much fun.
I watched Cube last week, which I've never seen before, and I actually liked quite a bit. Got some overacting, a pretty offensive handicapped character, and a not great ending, but the concept is really cool, which is these people wake up in this labyrinth that is like a giant cube composed of little cube rooms. Each room has six doors, one on each side, and some of the rooms are booby-trapped. It's got a cool score. Best part about it, that I won't go into too much, not to spoil it, is they do a lot of interesting things with the characters. Interesting turns and arcs and directions, including one, I was watching it with a friend of Secret Movie Club, Scott, and we both kind of, at the beginning, were like, we thought this one character was going to fall in a trope that main characters a lot of times fall into, and then they didn't. And it was very relevant to what happens, what's happening these days. And if you've seen Cube, you know what I'm talking about. And if you haven't, you should check it out. And I stream video games on twitch.tv/ConnorCruz.
I watched two things that captured me this week. The first one is a Russian film called Why Don't You Just Die, which is kind of a single location type of thriller. It's more of like a black comedy. And it's about a kind of a corrupt cop and his daughter's boyfriend. His daughter hires her boyfriend to kill him for reasons that I'll leave unsaid in this because it's very much a twisty, funny thing. But it's a pretty wild and incredibly violent, tight 90 minute, or maybe a little bit over, but it's sort of a Tarantino-esque bloodbath of a movie taking place in one location. It's very cool. The other thing I watched is Charlie Kaufman's new movie, I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
Ah, how was it?
I've never, you know, I don't really know. When I finished it, I was very uncertain, and I've thought only about it the last few days. It is almost completely incoherent, and the further I get, the more I think that's intentional. It is, someone described it as the equivalent of listening to great jazz. It fluctuates your emotions in ways you can't really maybe verbally explain. But if it catches you in that emotional, captures your emotion in that way, it plays you in the best ways. And it is this bizarre, sometimes funny, very sad, melancholy look at things. And I'm still trying to piece together what it's about or how I felt about or like what it made me think about. But it stars our boy Jesse Plemons.
The Plemons.
Which is important. And Jessie Buckley, who is, I believe she's from Scotland.
And Tony.
And yeah, Tony Collette.
And David Thewlis.
Yes, him as well. Tony Collette and David are Jesse Plemons' parents in it. But Jessie Buckley, I know her from the movie Wild Rose from last year. And she was also in Chernobyl, if you guys watched that. But she's unbelievable. Her and Jesse Plemons are incredible in this. And I think she... If this movie doesn't get her the recognition, she's on her way to something incredible because I think she's outstanding in this. I definitely recommend it. It's a tough watch.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it's happy-go-lucky.
No, it's bizarre.
Even the trailer, I was like, oh boy.
You need to be in a certain headspace to watch it and like give it some time. You'll have to really digest
but
it.
But I saw Anomalisa. I think I've seen everything Charlie Kaufman's done. And I've had this conversation, I think, with you. I think the only one of his movies that I love is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. That one I love, and not probably coincidentally, it's probably one of the happier ones of when you really think about it. But I always find his work ambitious, singular, and fascinating. And I take my hat off to him for that. He's always sort of swinging for the fences.
Yeah, this is, I would say, by far his least accessible movie.
Even more than Schenectady, New York?
Yes.
Whoa.
I love Schenectady, but this is operating at a different type of inaccessibility. I'm really interested to talk to people about it because it basically begs it because it gives you zero clarity and his its ambiguity is throughout. So it just begs conversation.
I will say pop culture wise, I finished the hat trick, the trifecta. I saw Patterson on Daniel's recommendation. I saw Super on Connor's recommendation. And while I was giving platelets, I saw Falling Down on Edwin's recommendation. And Edwin, it is a good movie. You were absolutely right.
It's a great movie.
Well, I will say this, and I want to say this the right way. I always will tip my hat off, and I mean this. This is not said politically. Anybody who makes a career out of filmmaking and directs movies, my hat goes off to them. And anybody who's able to direct 10, 20, 30 movies, that's the life I wish I had been leading, even though I wouldn't trade my life for anything. If someone said, hey, you could direct 30 movies, but you have to give up your kids and your wife, I'd be like, no way. Keep my kids and my wife. You can have your 30 movies. So I don't regret anything. But as somebody who thought, hey, I want to be directing movies from 27, and here I am 43 and I haven't directed a feature yet. When I see somebody make a career out of movies, my hat goes off. But I will say that I've not been the biggest Joel Schumacher fan, and I don't actively seek Joel Schumacher movies. And so when you said Falling Down, Edwin, I was like, well, I'm going to do it because it's Edwin. But it's not a movie. I'd heard it was good, but it was. It was really intelligent. It was really well made. I think it's probably the best Joel Schumacher movie I've ever seen.
It is.
Yeah, I was going to say by heads and tails. And I think it does this fascinating thing where you kind of relate with Michael Douglas, but you actually realize slowly you're following a ticking time bomb. And I love what it does is it shows how someone doesn't realize they're the bad guy. And yet at the same time shows why someone gets like that, why someone would maybe shoot up a place or why somebody would lose it. And I think Duvall gives one of his great performances. He's more in Tom Hagen mode from The Godfather than kind of scenery chewing mode. And the ending of the movie, the last shot of the movie, is legitimate brilliant. So Edwin, I have to tip my hat to you. That last shot of the movie, I have to be very, very clear. I find Joel Schumacher to be very heavy handed. And that last shot that goes back into the house to the home movie, I really teared up and I was like, wow, that is a perfect, brilliant.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, that is a perfect, brilliant last shot to what this movie was about. So I do have to say, I thought it was a very good movie and you all schooled me and you broadened my horizons.
Schumacher redemption arc. May you rest in peace.
Yeah. So Edwin, thank you. And yeah, RIP Joel Schumacher. Joel Schumacher, thank you for your film Falling Down. It was truly really good.
Thank you for Batman Forever.
If you think about it, it's kind of like a 90s Taxi Driver in a kind of way.
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally. No, the Taxi Driver's DNA is all over that movie. It's like Taxi Driver in LA for sure. And then like we've been saying, and we will post this. I discovered some links. There are about 50-ish days to the election, November 3rd. You can go to vote.org. It's real easy and you can find out your deadlines. The soonest deadlines to register are actually around October 1st. So for everybody who wants to register to vote, you're still good, but you got 2 weeks. And so go to vote.org. Also, I found out how you a site for you to be a poll worker. If you want to be a poll worker, you get paid. We'll post that. And I'm going to keep it simple there because I said 10 to turn. And until I've called my 10 people and registered to vote or make sure they are voting, I'm not going to say anything else because then I'm just lecturing and being a hypocrite. But remember 10 to turn, hashtag 10 to turn. If you can find 10 people who live in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, Texas, Ohio, Iowa, Nevada, Florida, any of those states, just call them up, make sure they're registered, make sure they know where their polling place is or how their mailing goes, and make sure that they feel good and they're going to do it.
And visit us at secretmovieclub.com where you can find everything.
Everything. And guys, thank you. You're all busting your asses. Connor is editing like a madman. He is, just so you know, I'm going to praise all you guys. This is how we're going to go out. Connor is editing every podcast you hear, every radio hour you hear, and every pre-show you watch. Daniel is essentially answering almost every email you write to community. He is troubleshooting how we park people. He's troubleshooting AV equipment. He's bringing on people to help with parking. He is doing almost all the logistical nuts and bolts to make this run and constantly giving efficiency ideas and never, ever once complaining about it and just doing it out of the goodness of his soul and his heart, which really humbles me because, Daniel, you really are doing doing that. And it really, you're sort of the ideal way to be as a person. But the only danger with your personality is that people will take advantage of you. And I hope to God that we neither take advantage of you, but we reward you for everything you're adding to this company and this team. And Edwin is just always working every single show, giving ideas, making suggestions. And Edwin is always telling it the way it is. I really have to give this up. Edwin, it was hot. And Edwin looked at my suit and he was like, I don't remember how you said it. And you were like, God, man, you look horrible.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? And you were like, you have got sweat stains everywhere. And I'll tell you something. Most people would not say that because they'd be like, Edwin just told me and I needed to know that. And I looked at my suit and I was like, oh, Edwin, thank you for being honest with me. I wore a suit, a different suit the next day. And if Edwin hadn't been direct, and Edwin's always direct, Craig, why'd you pick this movie? Why'd you do it this way? Why are you? And Edwin, I search my whole life for people who'll be honest with me because you need that when you're creating things and you're that person. So thank you.
I hear the truth. The truth will set you free. Or as Jack Nicholson will say, you can't handle the truth.
So guys, have a great week. I wish you all the best. I'll see you in a week. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.